Hi, welcome to Managing Myeloma. My name is Dr. Joshua Richter, and I'm joined today by my colleague, Dr. Ajay Chari. We both work at the Tisch Cancer Institute at the Mount Sinai Hospital. And today we're going to discuss the most exciting and impactful news from the International Myeloma Working Group meeting held in September of 2019, as well as the American Society of Hematology meeting in December of 2019. When patients do truly have symptomatic disease, I think it's been an argument for many years, what is the optimal upfront therapy? Do you move everything upfront? Do you sequence it out? There's a lot of new interesting studies between Alcyone, Griffin, and Cassiopeia about using four drug regimens in the upfront setting. And I would ask you, where do you think these fit in today and in the future, and would it change if you're transplant eligible or not?
Yeah, great questions. I think part of the discussion about the number of drugs, you really, the granularity matters, which is which four drugs are we talking about? So for example, we know that the evolution study, which showed that VRd plus cyclophosphamide did not add anything and it hurt patients. So we can't just have a blanket statement that four is better than three. And then the second question is, if you are gonna do four drugs, what is the duration of therapy, and what will patients end up becoming resistant to? So with that setup, you know, probably the study and then the drug that has moved the fastest and moved into newly diagnosed is daratumumab because of its safety profile and easy combinability. Basically, Dara is improved with practically every other backbone agent at this point. And so the question is, what does it add to for newly diagnosed population? So if we start with the transplant ineligible population, we know that Dara has already been approved with RD based on the Maya study and the and also the Alcyone study, Dara with VMP. So I think the update for that from the Dara VMP, depending on whether you think of melphalan as a quad or not, right? But if you think of Dara VMP, I think the most interesting update from Mary V. Mateos was that not only did PFS get improved, but OS improved. And that's a really important, people might think, oh, we're so used to seeing this, but this is very important because one of the pushbacks to frontline Dara is that, well, I'm going to use up all my drugs and then people are going to be resistant and then I'm going to have more complicated relapses. And I think what this tells us is what many of us have assumed that, and this has been shown very beautifully by Dr. Young in British Journal of Hematology, that we have issues of attrition and diminishing returns. Our best chance of getting a deep, durable response is that first response. And so not everybody makes it to the second relapse. So where are you saving that drug for if the patient's not even going to be alive? And then the response duration and depth also is worse as you go by. So I think that's Dara VMP confirms that if you get a better PFS, it can translate into an OS, and it's not that Dara is giving you more resistant relapses. So I thought that was a very important presentation. What do you think about the transplant ineligible population?
I agree. I think because OS takes so long to read out, any study that demonstrates OS is something we should really lock onto very big. And you know, even VMP, the comparator, that showed OS from way back when from the VISTA study. So adding daratumumab here, I think, is a really important study. Although, as you pointed out, I think Alcyone is more of a regimen ex-US.
Right.
That being said, I think the Maya study, Dara-RD, it really has the potential to move upfront in the US as a very big regimen for the transplant ineligible.
And I think we heard that the control arm, RD, in that study is now 33 months, which is amazing because if the median PFS has not been reached for Dara-RD and the control arm is 33 months, that's amazing.
Absolutely.
For a transplant ineligible population, that's a game changer. We're saying that our newly diagnosed older population is on a frontline therapy for more than 3 years, right?
It's amazing. And you know, we don't know yet where DRD is going to read out. The last I heard was, if you kind of look at the curves, we're probably looking at maybe 50 to 60 months for the DRD. I don't know if you've heard anything different.
Yeah, no, I think we will have to see. And also, what's good about DRD is you're actually continuing the RD backbone, not terminating, which is a criticism of a lot of the bortezomib.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and I think that's something that's a very important point, is that many of the triplet trials, both upfront and relapse, at some point stopped the third drug. And when you dropped the third drug and went to a doublet, that's a criticism. It's not able to control the disease as well using multiple mechanisms of action. The CASTOR study and Alcyone had to stop the bortezomib to compare to registration. So I do agree that if we were able to continue it, we probably would have had better outcomes, whereas where Maya absolutely excels.
Right. So then moving, I guess, to the transplant-eligible population, we heard basically three major regimens. We have DARA-VTD from the Cassiopeia, DARA-VRD from Griffin, and then DARA-KRD from two U.S. studies that were single-arm. So I think the one with the longest follow-up is probably the one to start with, which is Cassiopeia. DARA-VTD showed not only better response rates, depth of response, but also what I find very surprising, this was DARA-VTD with transplant, and this is prior to the maintenance therapy starting. The addition of DARA at 18-month follow-up already led to a PFS benefit, which I was actually surprised by, because if we just talked about how good the myo patients are doing, here at 18 months with the addition of DARA, we're already seeing a PFS improvement. And so that, I think, sets up the Griffin study, which, of course, the American criticism to all European things is, oh, we don't do that. What if you used RVD? And so Griffin is showing similar deepening of responses with more stringent CRs after induction, transplant, and consolidation. So I think we have two studies now showing that that these quads are definitely adding to the depth of response. We have to keep in mind toxicity, and I think one of the things to be mind of all of the frontline studies and even relapse, the addition of DARA does increase the rate of infections, typically grade 1 and 2, not grade 3 and 4. And then the other thing that came up with Griffin, which is different from Cassiopeia a little bit, is the collection. So we know that in Cassiopeia, there was really no difference in the stem cell yield, but there it was with thalidomide, which is not myelosuppressive, and there in Europe, Cy mobilization is used. In Griffin, in the U.S. study, there was no Cy mobilization permitted per unless patients failed. So it was primarily plerixafor G-CSF. And we did see a hint of lower stem cell collection and perhaps more need for extra collection. So I think that's something we have to keep in mind. But and I guess I will just close the kind of the for the folks listening, the DKRD. And the key message, if you're going to use DKRD, I think for community folks is quads are great, but carfilzomib with lenalidomide, or any IMID for that matter, we have to pay attention to the dose and schedule. Carfilzomib is approved in basically a gazillion different doses and schedules, but for the sake of simplicity, if you're going to do it with an IMID, I don't think it's prudent to go more than 56 milligrams per meter squared weekly. And that's what both of these studies did. They did weekly DARA, carfilzomib 2056, with lenalidomide and dex. So I think that's an important message if you're going to use DKRD. And I'll just say that these responses are great. With the COSTA study, it was interesting. They have potentially, if you have two consecutive MRD negative time points, you can discontinue that treatment and monitor these patients. I think we can talk more about that. But I guess the first question is, are you going to use quads in your clinic these days?
So, interesting thought. I have not yet completely embraced quads up front for a number of reasons. First of all, as you pointed out, DARA may affect collection. We thought when DARA was approved, oh, this is a new Rituxan, we're just going to add it to everything. But it turns out that as opposed to Rituxan, which is CD20, CD38 is on almost everything. It's on a lot more than just plasma cells. So it does affect other things, may affect stem cells at some level and K cells clearly. The other issue is it probably does matter how you achieve your deep remission. That if you get there with VRD, is that the same than if you needed DARA-VRD to get there? And I'm not quite sure that's the case. Some of the interesting subgroup analysis of at least Cassiopeia was that the addition didn't seem to help the high-risk patients. So for those people that are high-risk and transplant-eligible, at least for me, I don't see DARA as the vehicle to overcome the high-risk nature of their disease. How do I overcome that? I look to the Forte trial for whatever that's worth, where it seems that both KRD arms did better than KSID, but those who went on to stem cell transplant probably did better if they had high-risk disease than if they continued with just the 12 cycles of KRD.
Yeah, I think you bring up some very important points with the high-risk study. So I think when we talk about high-risk, we have to, putting aside the definitions because that in itself is complicated, but whether a drug's utility in a particular risk patient population, the ideal way to do it is you need four arms in the study. You need standard risk with standard therapy, standard risk with novel therapy, high risk with standard therapy, high risk with novel therapy. And I think study after study is showing, and this isn't true just for DARA, but no drug truly has overcome high risk, with perhaps the only exception of proteasome inhibitors and translocation 414. Everybody does better with the novel agents, but high-risk patients are still having a lower survival curve than the standard risk, and I think even with the novel therapy. So I think that is an important point. However, no study other than perhaps two has actually shown that the high-risk patients are being hurt by the novel therapy. And I think the two examples I'm getting at are thalidomide with 17p deletion actually does worse. And we've heard recently that venetoclax patients in high-risk patients do worse, right? So I think that goes back to the Alcyon study where there was no decrease in overall survival. And that's the other point of the overall survival as an endpoint. Yes, we want early readouts, so we want to use MRD as in a clinical trial, maybe for regulatory. Yes, we want to use PFS, but we can't forget that the OS still needs to be looked at, because if you're compromising your outcome, then we shouldn't be doing that. And so that's why I think Alcyon doesn't show we hurt high-risk patients. And I think the Forte study is very important. But one of the challenges that we really do, you know, everybody always, in fact, they were one of the ASH oral presentations, I'm sure you heard him say that, is like, we're not supposed to do cross-trial comparisons. That comparison is so dangerous, is that doses, schedules, and durations of chemo matter. And for example, in the Forte study, if you're not getting a transplant, it was 12 cycles of KRD. Who's getting 12 cycles of KRD in the real world?
Very few people.
Right? And so it's very important that when community doctors look at these studies, and when people want to do, for example, even KRD versus VRD, guess what? The VRD schedules are all 21 days. The KRD schedules are 28 days. So 4 cycles of each is actually more chemo with KRD. So you can't even compare KRD 4 cycles to VRD care cycle. So all of these cross-study comparisons are really fraught with issues. And I think it's difficult to know what to do with that. I personally think as long as you're not using all 4 drugs to progression, I'm in favor of it. And I think Cassiopeia is showing a PFS benefit. I don't think the patients or the healthcare system can tolerate quads for everyone forever.
Completely agree. I think for a lot of these patients, we're going to start off with quads. And then if we achieve sustained MRD negativity, for some we'll stop. Others are likely to continue them on something like Darin, Revlimid, long term. Interesting, and I'll ask you this mostly because you have an investigator-initiated trial looking at this. Is there a role for quadruplets in the older or frailer patients?
Yeah, I think we're obviously investigating that because, again, going back to it, I don't think it's a number of drugs. It's the doses and schedules, right? So, for example, I would bet money that RD full dose with lenalidomide 25 milligrams and Dex 40 would be much more poorly tolerated than lower dose of len with weekly bortezomib and lower Dex. And there's an example of 2 versus 3. So you really have to be careful because we know that newly diagnosed patients have a significantly impaired quality of life from the disease itself. And I would submit that older patients, just like amyloid patients, are just as deserving of a rapid, deep response. But we have to not end up getting them in the hospital. And so I think the key is picking the doses and schedules. So, but I think right now we need to be careful because we unfortunately don't have a lot of prospective studies about the frailty index. We know that the frailty has been shown to be an independent predictor in myeloma outcomes, but we don't have prospective risk-adapted treatment yet. So I think our gut would tell us that the truly frail patient, we may not necessarily want to do quads for everyone, and especially when you have a triplet like DRD, which is doing so well. I mean, if your PFS hasn't been reached, it's going to be very hard to beat that, right? But I think, again, maybe for those high risk, those fitter, older patients, there may be a role. What do you think, quads?
No, I completely agree. I think that from Betsy O'Donnell's RVD Lite, which I think a lot of people use as a management for the older patients where we dose reduce the len down to, say, 15, we give the bortezomib weekly instead of twice weekly, I would completely agree that I would rather give that type of approach than full dose len dex in the same patient. And I believe you're absolutely correct that there are patients where we could add the DARA to the RVD light backbone. And, you know, if we do our due diligence in the clinic to do the frailty indices like Charlson and things of that nature, Freiburg, we may be able to find the patients who can withstand this and will ultimately benefit from it. Looking at the treatment landscape for what we've seen now in upfront, and now we have so many drugs to choose from in the relapse refractory setting, I think we're ushering in a new age where there is so many treatments available for relapse and refractory patients. And we've seen some updates from IMW and from ASH with drugs such as venetoclax, isatuximab, melflufen, and a variety of others. Venetoclax is obviously a very well-known drug to a lot of our partners who treat other hematologic malignancies, as it's already approved in myeloid leukemia, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. It was been studied in the Bellini study, which was the registration study looking at venetoclax, bortezomib, and dexamethasone versus bortezomib, dexamethasone. Unfortunately, that trial was put on hold by the FDA due to increased AEs and deaths in that arm. However, venetoclax is really shown excellent responses in two types of myeloma, both the translocation 11-14, as well as those who overexpress BCL2, which makes a lot of sense as it's an oral BCL2 inhibitor. The hope is that the lift comes off and that we're able to move forward with this drug in myeloma. I'm curious to hear your thoughts. Where do you think venetoclax is going to fit into the landscape?
It's, you know, we keep talking about personalizing medicine and not treating everybody the same. And I think this is our first genomically kind of targeted therapy, if you will. So I think the 11-14 is really promising. One of the challenges to the high BCL2 is whenever you link a drug approval to a diagnostic test, it becomes the question of how is that diagnostic test being done? What is a high BCL2? What's the cutoff? So I think that will take a little bit more work. But I think the data that we heard at ASH, a couple of presentations showed that not only there was the addition of venetoclax for heavily treated patients and showed very encouraging response rates and durability. I think response rates were 40 to 50% and very encouraging durability compared to other diseases. And this is in median of 5 lines of prior therapy. So as venetoclax and dexamethasone, that's very encouraging. And then we also heard about the addition of daratumumab. And so I think which was associated with very good responses as well. Of course, I think it's, as we alluded to earlier, that this is a good example of toxicity needs to be thought of as well, but clearly very promising for 11-14 patients.
Absolutely. So I think this really broadens our horizons, especially as I think we're all very comfortable giving the combinations of IMIDs and proteasome inhibitors early on, now monoclonals early on, and unfortunately, despite these amazing outcomes, people do eventually relapse. So having new classes of agents in myeloma doesn't give us one new therapy, but ultimately gives us many new therapies, as venetoclax appears to be able to be combined both with proteasome inhibitors, given a single agent combined with monoclonals, so it really does open it up for the relapse and refractory patients. Another drug that I'm very excited to see the approval of is melflufen, also called Weigallo. The updates from Ocean and Horizon were discussed. This is a really interesting drug, as it's basically the newfangled version of melphalan as a peptidase approach. And from my standpoint, I think it's the wonders of it is that as a monthly infusion, it's very convenient for patients potentially. Also, as patients are getting deeper and deeper remissions up front, I think we may see patients, fewer and fewer of them, potentially go into high-dose melphalan with transplant. And outside of the U.S., probably, or inside the U.S., not getting much melphalan as part of their upfront therapy. So we're going to be seeing more and more patients who become dual refractory, quad refractory, penta refractory, and are still alkylator naive. So I think this may represent a new great option for our patients. Any idea where melflufen may fit in?
So melflufen, I think, is very promising data. We're seeing that response rate of the sweet spot of 30%, PFS of 3.5 months. That seems to be where you need to be for a novel agent in the heavily treated population, especially for an accelerated approval. I guess the challenge I'm always wondering is, you know, we always want to think about novel mechanisms of action. And yes, myeloma cells have increased immunopeptidase, making them more vulnerable to this target. But we did a study, for example, with a salvage transplant, melphalan resulted in a 6-month PFS, so in a median of 4 lines of prior therapy. So my question is always, if you're going to give this monthly drug of melflufen, how would it compare against MEL-140, a one-time intervention, right? And again, we don't have that data, but I think there are going to be certainly patients who either may not have stem cells or are not candidate for myeloablative type of therapy where this might be a great agent for patients like that. And I think one of the other differences between U.S. and Europe is, of course, Europe, they use a lot more alkylators, both melphalan and cyclophosphamide. But so far, I haven't seen that there's been a major difference in prior alkylator or not, so we'll have to see more data.
Absolutely, and one of the things you pointed out earlier about something we see with daratumumab infusions that although it's controlling disease very well, we are seeing a higher risk of infections from hypogammaglobulinemia. One of the toxicities of chronic alkylator therapy with melflufen is the cytopenias have been a bit of an issue. So patients who are a little more pretreated may not have the same marrow reserve, may not do as well with chronic alkylator exposure such as this. So definitely has to be balanced. In July 3rd of 2019, we saw the FDA's first approval of selinexor, a lot of this based off of your New England Journal of Medicine article from the STORM study, ushering in a new class of agents, the selective inhibitors of nuclear export. And some of the updates that we saw at IMW and ASH relate to the STOMP trial, using selinexor as a backbone, combining it with all of the other classically used agents in myeloma, the proteasome inhibitors, the IMIDs, and the monoclonal antibodies. Some of the very interesting data was the combinations with the IMIDs and the wonders of combining a sign with an IMID and steroids is now we have a highly effective all-oral regimen to potentially offer patients. Your thoughts on optimal combinations of selinexor as we move into 2020?
Yeah, I think one of the challenges with selinexor that we also had is the toxicity management. And I think there's a learning curve. But when you learn how to use it, it's a very effective drug, and as a co-author on the paper, you know very well the risk-benefit balance of this drug. And I think one of the important things is that the STORM study that was published in the New England was the intent of that was really to show, does this have single-agent activity, and can this get accelerated approval? So in a heavily treated population, it showed that response rate of in the mid-20s%, PFS of 3.5 months. And while that may not seem that encouraging, we have to remember who these people were. And they were heavily pretreated. Over 95% were CAR, POM, and DARA refractory. And there was a 22% increase in their paraprotein from the day they signed consent to 12 days later. So these are not patients that could wait the months for a CAR T slot. So but what I'm bringing that up in the context of what you're saying is you need that STORM study to show that this has single agent activity. Is this drug in the category of carfilzomib, pomalidomide, and DARA? Or is this in the category of ixazomib, elotuzumab, panobinostat, which are approved but in combination because of lack of single agent activity or lack of approval. So this puts this into the single agent category, but no one, myeloma is too genomically complicated to be treating with single agents. And none of those drugs, CAR, POM, or DARA, are typically being used as a doublet therapy. So I think the purpose of the STOMP is to show that you can combine it. And the key is, again, going back to doses and schedule. If you're giving selinexor as a single agent with Dex, it's twice weekly. But when you throw in a third drug, you can give it weekly. And depending on an IMID or versus a PI or monoclonal, the dose goes up and down because of the myelosuppression. So I think SPD is another great option, completely oral. So hopefully more patients will benefit.
Absolutely. SPD, which had received a lot of excitement on Twitter, that some very prominent myeloma physicians were very excited about the data. Also anticipating the results of the Boston study combining weekly selinexor with bortezomib, another very potent regimen. Something you pointed out, which I think is really important to share, is the management of the toxicity, that the drug is highly active. But one of the things that we do here at our institution is prophylactically go about preventing as much of the GI side effect as possible by giving multi-agents, including things like relepotent, Varubi, things like olanzapine, which is Iprexa, 5-HT3, steroids. We really have a whole protocol. As many of you all know, that once a patient develops nausea and vomiting, you're already behind the eight ball. It's much harder to deal with. So being upfront about the side effects and being aggressive about controlling them, you're able to weather that beginning of the storm, no pun intended, and get them through and allow them to continue on their regimens with the appropriate dosing. The other thing that we've also seen is the potential need to include things such as TPO mimetics like Nplate, Romiplostim, Eltrombopag, Promacta. I think these are agents that, at least in the myeloma world, we don't use very often, but they may be needed here to support the patient, at least in the beginning of therapy, to help clear out the marrow.
And the other thing worth mentioning in toxicity management is the drug has a very short half-life. So worst case scenario, you're trying all these things, but if you're having problems, you hold the drug, side effects clear, and then you restart at a dose level lower. So I think those are the tricks that people need to be aware of to help get patients through this drug.
Absolutely. So really excited to see some of the upcoming data and the combination studies with Boston and STOMP. Switching gears for a moment, One of the big excitements that we've seen a lot of updates, especially at ASH, from the CAR T studies, of which now there are quite a number of them, including the Legend CAR T, which we're doing many of the studies here. Very exciting new data with the possibility of a different CAR T, BB2121, isocel, being approved next year in 2020. Some of this data was presented by our very own Deepa Madhuri. Very exciting new data from the CARTITUDE study, looking at the Legend J&J CART, the fully humanized CAR T in patients who are heavily pretreated with some very, very impressive results. For those of you who may not be as familiar with this technology, CAR T is chimeric antigen receptor T cells. Essentially, we take patients in the study who are heavily pretreated. We first lymphopheresis them to collect their T cells. In the lab, they're engineered to target BCMA, a B cell maturation antigen, which is located on all myeloma cells. The patient then has to undergo bridging therapy while this process is going through to keep them in remission or to hold their disease at bay, at which point we need to create immunologic space. So we give lymphodepleting chemotherapy with cyclophosphamide and fludarabine, after which we reinfuse the CAR T cells. The patients typically stay in the hospital for approximately 14 days, with the big issue is monitoring for CRS, or cytokine release syndrome, which is a sign of activation of the immune system that goes along with the infusion of the CAR T, which has its own issues with managing with a variety of different drugs, such as tocilizumab, anakinra, even steroids or chemotherapy if needed. I think we're all really excited to see drugs like this or therapies like this enter the clinic. What are your thoughts on the CAR Ts?
From a patient perspective, to have a single intervention and have a from blue BB2121, a PFS of around a year, I think is amazing, because we've talked about all these other therapies in relapse refractory segments that typically last for 3.5 month duration for PFS median and require ongoing therapy. So from a patient perspective, to be penta refractory or triple class refractory, 7 lines of prior therapy, and get one treatment and be free of any therapies for a year, I think is amazing. The caveats, of course, are the CRS management, the tremendous patient selection that's going on, because there are limited slots. There's the manufacturing process, which you'll have attrition, the bridging chemo, and the impact of that on PFS. So this is primarily now applying to transplant-eligible population. So I think that's a second issue. And then the third issue, I would say, is the cytopenias and management of supportive care. So yes, it's a one-time intervention, but a substantial number of patients will require ongoing blood count support or IVIG, et cetera. So I think those are some of the things to think about, but clearly very exciting for patients. And I think we're very early in the side effect management, and perhaps we'll get to more sick patients, more fragile patients, if we get better at that CRS prophylaxis, because it would be like giving melphalan transplant, but not yet knowing the antiemetics and diarrheal mm-hmm. and growth factor support.
Absolutely. And one of the things you alluded to earlier was this the difficulty of comparing trial to trial, study to study. So you mentioned that with BB2121, we've seen in the heavily refractory patients, median outcomes of around 12 months. In one of the abstracts, they looked at the Chinese Legend CAR T and patients in China achieving a median PFS of 28 months for people who achieved MRD negativity. Now, because different drugs are available in different parts of the world, heavily pretreated in one country is going to differ from another country. So there are less exposure to drugs like pomalidomide or even daratumumab. But one of the things that I think this brings encouragement is, as the studies move these therapies further and further up, at least in the US, the possibility of having extremely long durations of remission, and I don't know, dare I say the word cure potentially, if we use it in the right patient in the right way.
Absolutely. I think what I'm also very interested to see is how this might do for the high-risk patients, right? Because that is truly an unmet need. None of the drugs have overcome high risk, and it'll be very interesting. Those studies are already open. And so for early relapses of high-risk patients, rather than blowing through the usual cocktail of drugs one after another with diminishing returns, can we do something more innovative like CAR T? So it'll be very exciting to see those results.
Absolutely. Your thoughts on, because you mentioned earlier, I guess a lot of us are kind of considering, are you CAR T eligible in the same vein of, are you transplant eligible? Do you see CAR T as a substitute for transplant for some patients?
Absolutely. I mean, I think definitely for those high-risk patients, we're not doing as well. And so I think there, and it may not be even an either or, we could do both, right? Because perhaps that if you take a patient who gets melphalan transplant and you've debulked them significantly, and you have these rich, juicy T cells that from a relatively newly diagnosed patient that are going to be more engageable in the control of disease, can you use the CAR T as a consolidation? So I think all of these need to be investigated, and then of course we haven't talked about the long term. What we know that transplant will increase the risk of secondary malignancies with Len maintenance. Might we not see that with CAR T? So I think the long term data we have for CAR T is very limited, but I think that'll be really exciting to see.
Absolutely. Use the term engage. So I'm going to use that as a segue to the bispecific T cell engagers. I think over the last year, we've seen a lot of interesting data about using off-the-shelf products that target BCMA, both from the data presented about belantamab mafodotin, AMG-701, and most recently at ASH, some interesting findings from the Celgene product, the off-the-shelf product. These have a number of distinct advantages over the CAR Ts in that they're off-the-shelf. There's no reason for bridging therapy. They are titratable. If someone's in the back having a problem, you can turn it off. If you give a CAR T and someone has horrible CRS, that is a little more complicated to manage. Cost is definitely something to consider across all of this. And the other thing is access. We have the luxury of having access to many things at our center. Many patients don't have the access now to even things such as transplant. So access to CAR Ts may become a very big issue following approval. The ability to give off-the-shelf BCMA products is something to overcome that. Your thoughts on the landscape of BCMA?
I think, well, obviously, this is the new unanswered question is the sequencing. So we have these three different approaches, the BiTEs, the ADCs, and the CAR-T, but what if you get one? Can you not get the other? And obviously, that gets to the biology of relapse and resistance. But I think what I would, you know, again, we don't have any cross-trial comparisons, but if I were to think in my mind, we take a patient below the age of 70 because they would be potentially CAR-T eligible, and you said, okay, I'm going to randomize them to either the CAR-T, bispecific, or the ADC, what would you pick? And I think the ADC's strength is really the ease of infusion. 30-minute, you know, no CRS, super convenient, but those ocular issues that require monitoring or limitation, and the PFS, we don't have long-term data yet. Whereas the CAR-T, we know that single intervention gives you that year. But the bispecifics, I think, have a real play. I mean, the Celgene data were quite impressive, very high response rates, durable remission so far, even the deep ones. And so if you can get that PFS of CAR-T without bridging chemo, because remember, CAR-T, some of that PFS may be lost if the manufacturing period was shorter and you didn't give bridging chemo. So I think that's the key question is, and we know that in lymphoma, there's about a 20% attrition from the day you sign consent to who actually gets to CAR-T. And I don't think you have that attrition with the bispecific and ADC because they're off the shelf.
Absolutely.
What do you think?
No, I completely agreed. As you talked about with the STORM study, patients who are heavily pretreated may have kinetically very aggressive disease that either doesn't have time to wait or in the period while waiting, they have some sentinel event preventing them from getting their CAR-Ts. And we're seeing this in the myeloma space, in the lymphoma space. Some studies showing 10 to 15, even 20% of people queued up to get CAR-T never get it because of disease progression, infectious complication, or some other adverse event. So off-the-shelf products are absolutely going to help for people who need therapy immediately. The high kinetic plasma cell leukemics may be able to treat very quickly. Do share your concern about the complexity of dealing with the ocular toxicity of belantamab. The Celgene data was quite impressive for their off-the-shelf product. Very interested to see what the long-term data is, because as you pointed out earlier, early data, we get very excited, but this needs to stand up under higher rigor with phase two and phase three studies. Turning to a slightly different area, and this is a study that you have a very close connection to, the CANDOR study, looking at the combination of carfilzomib, daratumumab, and dexamethasone in relapse refractory myeloma, compared with carfilzomib and dexamethasone alone. This study was presented recently, and very exciting new data. For me, there's two very important parts about this study that really bring it to light. One is that the triplet was continued, and as compared to the CASTOR study where the proteasome inhibitor was stopped, the notion of continuing triplet therapy to intolerable toxicity or progression is, in my mind, the correct way to approach, especially heavily relapsed and refractory patients. The other notion is, over the last decade, we have had a large number of studies looking at lenalidomide-based triplets in the early relapse. We've had Aspire, Pollux, I'm going to forget some of the others, but we've had a number of these studies with Lendex as a backbone. The difficulty is, nowadays, with the modern day approach, if you're transplant ineligible, you remain on lenalidomide till progression. And if you're transplant eligible, you remain on lenalidomide till progression. So ultimately, looking at early relapse in a len refractory patient group hasn't really been done as robustly until this study. So those old data, as impressive and informative as they were, doesn't have the same impact now when everyone's progressing on len. And about a third of the patients in CANDOR were len refractory by the time they entered. So to me, the applicability to the bedside is enormous in this study. And I think this may have a big impact. Obviously, excited to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I completely agree. People always want to pit the PI versus IMIDs against each other with DARA, and it's not a fair comparison. Now we have a more fair comparison, but I think one of the questions people ask is this hazard ratio of the 0.6 range. Doesn't that seem worse than the other studies with the DRD, for example, 0.3 and even bortezomib 0.3? But I think the key here is we have to think about the patient population. What is the control arm? We're not using a historic old school control arm, right? This is not a VD. This is a K56 twice weekly. And that's important because Endeavor showed that 56 twice weekly is better than VD. Mm-hmm. So this is actually a next generation study trying to build on what we've already learned, not going backward and comparing DKD to VD, mm-hmm. right? So I think when the control arm does better, it gets even harder for the experimental arm to do better. I'm very curious to see in more detail the high risk outcomes, because again, we haven't overcome high risk. But I really echo your point about if you look at those three VD controlled backbone studies with prior len exposure, len refractory, mm-hmm. the outcomes of that subgroup are much worse. I mean, at best, we're looking at 8 to 11 months, whether even with the novel agent. Mm-hmm. And here with DKD, we've already surpassed that. So I think that's a real important real world message that if your patient is len refractory, make sure that your salvage treatment will be giving them the maximal benefit.
Absolutely. And again, one of the points you brought up earlier is making sure that you're aware of the dosage of carfilzomib that you're using when you start mixing it. There have been a lot of studies with carfilzomib over the past year, including Arrow, which has shown the ability to dose the drug safely at 70 milligrams per meter squared weekly. However, to your point, that was as the doublet with dexamethasone. When combining it with daratumumab or combining it with an IMID, really important to go back to the studies to see how it was dosed to avoid any overtoxicity.
An important distinction between the CANDOR and the DKD study that we did in 1001 is the dosing of carfilzomib. So this CANDOR is Endeavor dosing 56 twice weekly, but the one we did was K70 weekly. So with daratumumab, you can give it weekly. It's the IMID where I think you worry about that thrombotic cardiac profile, but I think in the real world, it may be hard to do 56 twice weekly to progression. So I'm thinking that people may start with, if they start with this 56 twice weekly, they can always go to then later 70 weekly again off label, but at least you're treating to progression, because the reality is, as you alluded to, treating to progression is the most important thing. And if the patient and physician and treatment team are getting tired of the twice weekly schedule, we need to have a practical weekly dosing.
Absolutely. So in the final moments, just want to kind of hear your general thoughts on data that was presented this year or data you're anticipating in the coming year in terms of what are you seeing as the immediate next steps in terms of our understanding of myeloma and how we're going to treat it.
I guess I would integrate it with where are the needs, right? So I think starting with the newly diagnosed, we have the high risk frail elderly. I think if those patients don't make it to line two, we're not going to have them around. High risk, we have done a terrible job. Central nervous system myeloma, plasma cell leukemia, and probably the last would be the multi-drug refractory patient. And I would now put into that category, we've already talked about triple class refractory, but we're going to have BCMA refractory patients. So I think, to me, those are the areas of unmet need, and we're starting to see some glimmers of activity. For example, we did see selinexor can work in post-CAR-T failures. So I think that's exciting, but that's going to be the next generation of studies that I'm interested in. What did you think, or what are you looking for?
So I think next year is going to be, or 2020, is going to be very, very exciting. There's a lot of new drugs that are probably going to come into our hands. So we have the potential for isatuximab to come into our hands. The PDUFA date, I believe, is April 30th. So from the Icarus study, ISA, Pomdex versus Pomdex, the data is very exciting. Again, hard to compare with the Equilis study, the DPD comparator, because the Icaria patients were not as heavily pretreated. That being said, the infusional nature of isatuximab is somewhat shorter than daratumumab, so this may provide some of the community centers that have difficulty with that first dose dara to give an anti-CD38 without the long infusion. However, as we're hoping for, the subcutaneous dara is not far behind. Melflufen, belantamab, mafodotin, venetoclax, all potential exciting approvals for next year, as well as BB2121. So something you alluded to earlier, which is the most complex question is sequencing, which is now that we have all these tools on our plate, how do you sequence? At the moment, BCMA-based therapy is placed after PIs, IMIDs, monoclonals. But should that be the case? Is it the case that BCMA should come earlier? And to your notion, I completely agree. The efficacy of selinexor shown in patients who've gone through prior CAR-T is something we're all going to need to remember, that as soon as CAR-T enters the field, unfortunately, it's not yet a cure, people are going to relapse from it. And so far, the only real data we've seen of how to treat post-CAR-T is coming from the STORM study with selinexor. So selinexor combinations, potentially post-CAR-T, may be very exciting. So I'm really hoping we get some new clarity about the sequencing of these different therapies, and especially for the BCMA, who should get an ADC, who should get a BiTE, and who should get a CAR-T. Thank you for viewing this activity.